Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll speak to best-selling author and documentary maker John Ronson about America's culture wars. COVID conspiracies, racial and gender identity politics, free speech culture wars, they all snowballed during COVID lockdown. But what role are they likely to play in this year's presidential election in the US? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used by somebody who was psychopathic.
Let's tell this story.
World of Secrets, Season 2, The Disciples. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 14 hours GMT, on Tuesday the 9th of January, these are our main stories. 2023 has been confirmed as the hottest year on record, as temperatures rose exceptionally across the globe. Reports of intense bombing in southern Gaza as the US Secretary of State meets the Israeli President in Tel Aviv, and a mixed response to South Korea's government's banning the killing and selling of dogs for food. Also in this podcast.
I had exchanged messages with my fictional mum. I looked at photos of families. I watched a bit of telly.
They changed the world with the iPhone. Will Apple do it again with VR headsets? We become used to hearing about world-breaking temperature records, but here's a hugely significant one. 2023 was the hottest year on record. Data from the European climate monitoring organisation Copernicus indicates it surpassed 2016 by 0.17 degrees Celsius. Well, to pick through this for us, I spoke to our environment correspondent, Matt McGraw.
Yeah, Nick, you might be forgiven for thinking that breaking the previous hottest year record by 0.17 degrees Celsius wasn't a great deal. But you have to put this in context. It's not just the hottest year, perhaps, since records began in 1850, but likely, according to many scientists, the warmest year in 100,000 years. And in that year we've just had, you have to look at the data from the middle of the year onwards, from June, July, every month on from June, essentially was hotter than any of the similar months in any previous year. We had more days last year. In fact, every day last year was over 1 degree warmer than the long-term records from 1850 to 1900. So it's very significant. We've known it's been coming. It's been predicted because the months have been so warm that it would break these records. And now we have the final confirmation, if you like, of just how hot it was.
And Matt, another very significant moment, because with an average 1.48 degrees above pre-industrial levels, it gets very, very close to that 1.5 degree threshold, doesn't it? Tell us, remind us, if you would, why that is so significant.
Yeah, the 1.5 degree threshold has become, I suppose, the real barrier for rising temperatures across the world in the last number of years, because scientists recognise that going beyond that number is essentially going into very uncharted territories, and the impacts get much higher beyond 1.5. This was recognised by politicians in the Paris Agreement in 2015, where they said they would do their best efforts to keep temperatures under 2 and even under 1.5. It's particularly important to small island states and developing countries who see that 1.5 as the gateway to survival. Going beyond that would see sea levels rise to such an extent that many countries might cease to exist. So seeing the temperatures last year go very close to this 1.5 degree threshold is a worry. Now, it's a dire precedent, scientists are calling it. It doesn't mean the threshold has been broken. That would need temperatures to be above 1.5 for 20 to 30 years. We're not at that yet, but the pointers, the indicators are going in the wrong direction.
Matt, El Nino, which are the warm ocean currents that are around at the moment, are pushing temperatures up. Are there any predictions about what the temperature will be next year?
Yeah, absolutely. El Nino is a very important factor in making 2023 the warmest year on record, but it also could, in fact, push 2024 to the warmest year on record title as well, because that El Nino is ongoing and gathering strength and will probably peak in the next couple of months. That pushes a lot more heat from the oceans up into the atmosphere, where it's warming this planet on an ongoing basis. Now, the view is that this may well be the warmest year, 2024, and the hope would be that in the years going beyond that, it would actually decline a little bit, but El Nino is certainly playing a big role, a second to the role of burning fossil fuels around the planet.
Matt McGrath there. And later we'll head to Mozambique to see how the country is continuing to battle the effects of climate change after a devastating cyclone hit its shores 5 years ago. That's coming up. To Israel now, and 5 days of diplomacy around the Middle East is culminating today in Israel for the US Secretary of State. Antony Blinken is in Tel Aviv, where he's been holding talks with the Israeli President, Isaac Herzog. Mr. Blinken is expected to repeat calls for Israel to do more to reduce civilian deaths in Gaza. He's due to meet the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, later. He told reporters that there was a lot to discuss.
I've just come from a number of countries in the region, Turkey, Greece, Jordan, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and I want to be able to share some of what I heard from those leaders with the president, as well as with the prime minister and the cabinet later today. And of course, we'll have an opportunity to sit with the families of some of the hostages and discuss our relentless efforts to bring everyone home and back with their families. And there's lots to talk about, particular about the way forward.
Well, Mr. Blinken's meetings coincide with reports of intense bombing overnight in Khan Yunis and Rafah in southern Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry says 57 people were killed in one central Gaza hospital alone, whilst the Israeli military has confirmed 9 of its soldiers have died in fighting. The BBC's Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell is in Jerusalem.
There's so much really for Mr. Blinken to talk about in this day of back-to-back meetings. First of all, it's how the war in Gaza is being fought, with a lot of concern about the very high numbers of civilian casualties that are being seen, the fact that people are being newly displaced. Israel's military is now saying that it's going to lower the intensity of fighting in the coming weeks. Otherwise, he wants to talk about getting more humanitarian aid into Gaza urgently, and getting Israeli hostages, the dozens of them that remain in Hamas captivity, out. And he is going to be meeting the families of Israeli hostages in the course of the day. Otherwise, it's about the regional spillover of the war. And Israel is having very high tensions at the moment on its northern border with Lebanon, where there's been almost daily fighting with the Lebanese armed group Hezbollah. A lot of regional concern about that. And Mr. Blinken is also bringing another message from his meetings with Arab leaders about the need to talk about the way forward for Gaza. That's both in terms of its post-war governance, but also longer term. He's saying that Arab states are holding out the possibility of more integration with Israel, but only if he's saying there is a practical pathway to creating an independent Palestinian state down the road.
Yolan Nell. We're going to go to the West Bank now, and a centre for disabled children in the Nur Shams refugee camp says essential items, including documents, food and clothes, were destroyed after an Israeli raid last week. The centre is funded by the UK charity ABCD, Action Around Bethlehem Children with Disability. Reverend Daniel Burton is a vicar in Oldham in the north of England, and he's chair of the trustees. He spoke to the BBC's Michelle Hussein.
As part of a larger raid on Nur Shams refugee camp, the centre was raided. Every room in the building was somehow vandalised. Papers about the care of the children were destroyed. Food and winter clothing for the children disappeared. And essential equipment from the building was thrown outside on the street. This was at night when the building was locked and there was nobody in the building at all.
Is there any possibility that this building was being used by Hamas or Hamas suspects?
Almost impossible. It is in a strategic location near the entrance to the camp. I've been there myself a couple of times in the past few years, but the building was empty. There's no evidence that it was being used for any other purpose. And it's hard to see the actions as anything other than wanton violence, really.
Who uses the building?
We care for about 250 children who have complex physical and learning disabilities over the course of an average month. It's a remarkable centre that ABCD Bethlehem has seen build up from one room to three floors over the last 8 years. It's become a comprehensive centre for rehabilitation. And these families, consequently, are now unable to access life-changing therapy.
That was the Reverend Daniel Burton there. And in response, the Israeli Defence Forces told the BBC the IDF conducts nightly counter-terrorism operations to apprehend suspects. Many of them are part of the Hamas terrorist organisation. In addition, as part of the security operations in the area, dynamic checkpoints have been put up over different places. For centuries, dog meat has been on the menu in South Korea. But from today, the killing and selling of dogs for food has been banned by the country's parliament, where the bill was passed by 208 votes to zero. Animal rights activists who put pressure on the government to outlaw the practice called the ban history in the making. Borami Seo is from the animal charity Humane Society International.
I still have goosebumps all over my body now. I never believed it was a part of Korean culture ever. Already it was time to end this cruel, cruel, brutal industry in South Korea. So this is a very, very meaningful step forward for animal welfare overall in Korea.
But the ban hasn't been welcome news for everyone. From Seoul, our correspondent Jean McKenzie has more details.
Dog meat is considered a delicacy among some older Koreans, but it's far less popular now with young people. Many of them never eat it now or have never even tried it. And so consumption is falling. And when we spoke to people about the ban, the generational divide was stark.
We've eaten this since the Middle Ages. Why stop us from eating our traditional food? If you ban dog, you should ban beef.
More people have pets today. Dogs are like family now, and it's not nice to eat our family. So I think it's best to get rid of it.
Under the new law, those who farm, butcher, or sell dogs to eat can be jailed for up to 3 years, though it won't actually be illegal to eat dog meat. It's hoped that the ban on selling will be enough to stop people from eating it. The ban won't come into force for another 3 years to give restaurant owners and farmers time to find another job or to transition their businesses. And the government has promised to support those who are forced to switch livelihoods. But the industry has been incredibly critical of this ban. They've argued that given the declining popularity of dog meat, the government should have just allowed it to disappear naturally over time.
What are we supposed to do now? We need to be compensated. I think we should accept dog meat, but raise and slaughter them in a hygienic environment.
In contrast, animal rights organisations have, of course, welcomed this ban. They have been campaigning for this for a long time, arguing that the practice is cruel and the conditions on the farms where the dogs are kept are poor. Previous governments here in South Korea have tried to ban this as far back as the 1980s. But the current president and the first lady are known to be animal lovers. They have six dogs of their own. And this is thought to be one of the reasons the bill has now passed.
Jean McKenzie. In our earlier edition, we brought you the news that the French Prime Minister, Elisabeth Borne, had resigned as President Emmanuel Macron tries to boost his political fortunes ahead of European elections. Now an update, and the country has a new Prime Minister, the youngest in modern French history. At just 34 years old, Gabriel Attal also becomes the first openly gay French Prime Minister. Hugh Schofield has more.
Gabriel Attal is a young Macron loyalist who's made a rapid ascent after being elected to Parliament in the wake of the president's first election victory in 2017. He became a familiar face when he was made government spokesman in 2020, and recently he served as education minister, winning plaudits from the president for his decisive handling of a row over the Muslim robe, the Abaya. Attal banned them in schools. He has energy, charm and fluency, qualities which you'll need in large amounts given the challenges that face him. These are the same problems that caused such difficulty to his predecessor, the outgoing Elisabeth Borne. A parliament with no inbuilt government majority so that every new law is a struggle, and a surging hard right under Marine Le Pen and her also youthful and increasingly prominent lieutenant, Jordan Bardella.
Hugh Schofield. Still to come.
I think it's the first time that Taiwan has issued an alert for the launch of a Chinese satellite. So that in itself is unusual.
Yeah, Taiwan issues that island-wide alert after a Chinese satellite enters its airspace days before a crucial presidential election.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll speak to best-selling author and documentary maker John Ronson about America's culture wars. COVID conspiracies, racial and gender identity politics, free speech culture wars, they all snowballed during COVID lockdown. But what role are they likely to play in this year's presidential election in the US? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Bolts in need of additional tightening and loose hardware on Boeing 737 MAX 9 planes. Those are some of the findings from airlines over the last couple of days since inspections began after a section of the fuselage fell from an Alaska Airlines plane last week. The US regulator, the Federal Aviation Administration, has grounded 171 planes. Turkish Airlines, Panama's Copa Airlines and Aeromexico have all grounded the MAX 9s for inspection. Our international business correspondent, Theo Leggett, has more.
They are worrying findings because they show that the problems were not confined to a single aircraft. Now, just to recap on what actually happened to this plane, minutes after takeoff, an unused door in the fuselage, which would have been concealed behind the interior trim, blew out and the aircraft depressurized very, very rapidly. There was a rush of air out of the aircraft. The pilot's headsets were ripped off. It was all very dramatic. But it happened when the aircraft was still fairly low, when people were still strapped into their seats. If that same incident had happened at cruising altitude at about 38,000 feet, it would have been a lot more severe. So that's why everybody is treating this with such caution and looking very carefully at what's going on. Now, it was pretty obvious immediately after the accident that something had gone wrong with that individual plane and that it was likely to be some kind of production or assembly problem, because the door in question has been used on other aircraft for many years. There's nothing new about that. There haven't been any particular problems. And this was a brand new aircraft, 2 months old, had barely done 200 flights. But what we're seeing now is that with the fleet grounded, all the equivalent design of plane, the equivalent configuration, they're being looked at. And both United Airlines and Alaska Airlines have found loose hardware, loose bolts. That is very strongly suggestive of a quality control problem on the production line. So the question then becomes, how far does this stretch and what other problems might there be? Is this indicative of a wider problem?
Theo Leggett. Mobile phones across Taiwan received an air raid alert on Tuesday after a Chinese rocket carrying a satellite flew over the island's southern airspace. The authorities in Taiwan have been on high alert as they gear up for presidential elections due on Saturday. One of the candidates, William Lai, has accused Beijing of unprecedented interference in an attempt to influence the outcome of the poll. He said, although China meddles every time Taiwan holds elections, this time it was the most serious ever witnessed. Earlier, our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more about the alert.
Well, the alert came at about 3 p.m. in the afternoon in Taiwan. It was issued to mobile phones to Taiwanese residents. Essentially what it said was that, well, in Chinese it said that China had launched a satellite, but in English, which has caused some confusion, it said that there was an air raid alert and a missile was flying over. So that's what it said in English. The Ministry of Defence afterwards apologised for that, saying it would be in a mistranslation. But the alert in itself, I think, is the first time that Taiwan has issued an alert for the launch of a Chinese satellite. So that in itself is unusual. Of course, makes people quite worried. And as you mentioned there, it comes just days before a presidential election in Taiwan. Now, that's important context because China believes Taiwan is part of its own territory. Taiwan accuses China of interfering in the election. So, of course, some people are going to see the timing of this satellite launch. The Taiwanese authorities said they weren't warned about it in advance as some kind of a warning or potential threat to Taiwan that China has some kind of rocket capabilities.
Okay. What's being said on the campaign trail, though? Because this is being seen as a seminal election, isn't it?
Yeah, interestingly, just a few hours before this, and to emphasise what went on afterwards, William Lai, one of the leading candidates, or perhaps the leading candidate to take over the presidency in Taiwan later this year, had warned of Chinese interference in the election. And it's certain China has been doing that. Over recent weeks, it's criticised particularly William Lai for his independence-leaning statements. Remember, China thinks that Taiwan's part of its own territory, doesn't want Taiwan to declare independence. So it has been interfering in that way. It has been sending planes. China has been sending planes to Taiwan as well. So this satellite launch, it's hard not to see it as some kind of involvement in the election campaigning going on in Taiwan at the moment.
Mickey Bristow. The Balkans region in Europe was riven by ethnic tensions and war after the collapse of Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. One of the countries to emerge from the chaos was Bosnia-Herzegovina, where peace accords created a state where Bosnian Muslims, Croats and Serbs shared power. Tensions have been rising again there. Its majority Serb region is marking a holiday that's been declared unconstitutional by the country's highest court. The president of the majority Serb area, Milorad Dodik, said they have a right to mark the day.
We're integrating. We're mentally integrated into Serbia. Of course, we're part of Bosnia now, but that's because we have to be. Bosnia-Herzegovina is not something we want. We don't wish any harm to the Bosnians and Croats in Bosnia, but I've never felt, for example, that Sarajevo is my city.
Our Balkans correspondent Guy Delaunay has more.
In 1992, secessionists declared a breakaway Serb republic on the 9th of January. Non-Serbs view that as the start of a campaign of forced displacement, illegal detainment and murder. Relatives of victims of the Srebrenica massacre want the date to be declared a day of mourning rather than celebration. This year's events will include a parade, a concert and coordinated fireworks displays in Republika Srpska's main city Banja Luka and Serbia's capital Belgrade. They're likely to exacerbate the ongoing power struggle between Republika Srpska's president Milorad Dodik and the international high representative Christian Schmidt.
Guy Delaunay. It's been almost 5 years since Cyclone Idai crashed into Mozambique's coastline. 1,500 people were killed, 3 million people were affected across three countries. Although the storm has long passed, the danger hasn't, as climate change is predicted to make such extreme weather conditions even stronger. After reporting on the rescue effort after Cyclone Idai, our correspondent Nomsa Maseko has returned to the city of Beira to meet the people trying to help their communities adapt.
At a college in Mozambique's second largest city, Beira, a group of building apprentices dressed in blue overalls are gathered around a small demonstration house. They're learning how to construct a roof that's been specifically designed to withstand the extreme winds and torrential rains that come with a cyclone. They're learning this because scientists expect cyclones and tropical storms to get stronger as a result of global warming, with higher wind speeds and more rainfall. Jose Joaquim is a former student at the Young Africa Training College who's been helping with today's lesson.
Because of the risk of the roof being blown away, we use these metal fixtures to reinforce it. Also, we reduce the distance between the wooden beams. The smaller the distance, the greater the safety. So with these resilient techniques, we think it can resist at least the force of winds that we saw during Cyclone Idai.
A stronger house can provide better shelter during a storm, but there are some areas around the coastal city of Beira which are so vulnerable that people need to evacuate when there's a strong cyclone predicted. So, the local council has set up a series of local disaster management committees. These are volunteers who tirelessly work year-round to prepare communities for emergencies and help them evacuate safely when they arrive.
It's overcast today. There was a pretty intense thunderstorm overnight, and you can tell that this is an area that gets easily flooded. We are here to meet Liria,
who lives in this area. She's also one of the volunteers.
So we work together. Whenever there's an emergency, like when cyclones appear suddenly, we are right there in the community, working with them. Then, at other times, we do the work of raising awareness. And I think the effects of these risks are reduced a little because people listen to what we have to say.
Another way of providing protection to vulnerable coastal areas is replanting mangrove forests, which have been cut down over the years for building materials and firewood. But for volunteers trying their best to help their communities, part of the solution lies far away from Mozambican shores, because it isn't lost on them the fact that Mozambique has caused a tiny amount of the greenhouse gas emissions driving climate change.
People in Beira are really unhappy with this situation caused by other countries. Here in Mozambique, we are already in trouble. And those countries are still doing these negative things. They shouldn't be making all this gas in other countries. They should let us live like we always did here in Mozambique.
In the meantime, people in Beira will continue to do what they can to adapt to climate change in the face of an uncertain future.
And you can listen to Nomsa Maseko's documentary today by downloading the documentary podcast. With large clunky headsets and an expensive price tag, sales of virtual reality sets slumped last year. It's got some people asking, is the virtual reality dream dead? No, says Apple.
When you put on Apple Vision Pro, you see your world and everything in it. Your favorite apps live right in front of you.
Well, the tech giants entering the market with their highly anticipated Vision Pro headset. They changed the world with the iPhone. Can they do it again with virtual reality? Our technology editor, Zoe Kleiman, has tried the Apple product out.
What's really interesting about the Apple Vision Pro, I think, is that it's got that Apple magic to it. So I tried it out in California last year, and I sort of went over there thinking, you know, what is Apple doing? Why is it doing this now? It's a really strange step for it to take. You know, the VR market has been going for years. It's quite late to the game, if you like. When I tried it out, it was very tightly curated by Apple, I have to say. You know, I was totally in their hands. But when I tried it out, I sort of realized what I think they're doing, which is they're looking for a successor to the iPhone. So everything I did on that headset was the kind of thing I do on my phone all the time. You know, I had exchanged messages with my fictional mum. I looked at photos of families. I watched a bit of telly. There wasn't a lot of kind of, you know, let's go and walk with dinosaurs. Let's go and fight aliens and sort of big landmark immersive gaming experiences that you're often sold with virtual reality. It was much more mundane than that. But of course, it being Apple, it was very, very slick. So the headset works with gesture control. So you just look at an app and you pinch your thumb and your index finger together and the app opens. Now, you can imagine that being a very frustrating experience if it doesn't work. But I have to say that in the 15, 20 minutes or so that I was doing it, it worked every single time. And I think people will appreciate that. And I think it will bring a market of people who perhaps are less patient with tech overall, but who trust the brand of Apple.
Of course, there's always a lot of hype surrounding these things. Famously, Mark Zuckerberg talked about the metaverse and how perhaps we were all going to be in this virtual reality world by now. That clearly hasn't happened. Is there a big hump to get over in terms of virtual reality? Is it price? Is it availability? What is it? Why hasn't it taken off?
It has taken off to an extent. There's a sort of lively market for it, if you like, but it's never hit the mainstream, has it? It's not got to the stage where we're all doing it all day long, which is the dream of people like Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Meta. I think there are a few obstacles in the way. I mean, number one is the headset. You know, even the Apple one, which is more like a pair of ski goggles, I guess, than the traditional headset, it's still clunky. Do you want to have that on your head for 4 hours? Do you want to put on a headset in order to send a text message? And I think Apple's plan is to reduce that. You know, ultimately, I would imagine that these things are all going to become more like a pair of glasses and less like a big clunky thing that you have to wear on your head. The battery life has been an issue because, of course, they use a lot of power. Now, Apple has decided to do that by detaching the battery so you can sit the battery next to you and charge it while you're actually using it. You've got to bear in mind as well, things have changed. You know, in 2014, when Meta bought a VR firm called Oculus, there wasn't the great broadband that there is now. There wasn't really the infrastructure to support it, and that is all changing. So I think it's possible that it will have its moment, but you do have to ask. It's been nearly 10 years and it hasn't happened yet, has it?
Zoe Kleinman. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen and the producer was Sean Wales. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
I'm Katia Adler, and today on The Global Story, I'll speak to best-selling author and documentary maker John Ronson about America's culture wars. COVID conspiracies, racial and gender identity politics, free speech culture wars, they all snowballed during COVID lockdown. But what role are they likely to play in this year's presidential election in the US? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.